From the Sky News Centre at 5, three of the four miners missing after floodwaters swept through a colliery in South Wales have been found dead. Rescue teams say they're determined to carry on searching in the hope of finding the fourth miner. Seven were there working. One of the men who became trapped yesterday is the father of one of three who managed to escape. Ron Griffiths is a friend of two of the miners, Gary Jenkins and Charles Breslin.
Two happy-go-lucky boys. Brilliant guys, brilliant guys. Always had a quarrels over the darts, me and Gary, but they were best of friends afterwards, like.
The men were stranded in a tunnel underground after a retaining wall holding back a body of water failed, flooding the shaft. Teams have worked around the clock to pump out the water. Chris Kitchen from the National Union of Mine Workers claims safety is not a priority in many smaller mines.
There are a lot of these small private mines that they've been there for years and years. They come into operation when the coal price is high, make a profit, and then they get mothballed when the prices drop. Historically, safety is not of a high standard like what we were used to in the British coal days.
The British Red Cross are helping family and friends of the miners and describe a spirit of community resilience in agonisingly anxious times. In other news, a suspected rogue trader has appeared in court over an alleged £1.3 billion fraud at banking giant UBS. Kwaku Adeboli wept in the dock as he appeared before City of London magistrates. A British soldier killed on patrol in Afghanistan has been named by the Ministry of Defence as Lance Corporal Jonathan James McKinley of the 1st Battalion the Rifle. The 33-year-old was killed by small arms fire on Wednesday. The appeal court has rejected a last-ditch attempt to prevent the clearance of the UK's largest illegal travellers' site. Residents are due to be evicted from Dale Farm at Basildon in Essex on Monday. And England's cricketers are being frustrated by India in the final one-day international at Cardiff. A short time ago, they were 186 for 2 in the 36th over. That's the latest. I'm Kevin Gober.
BCFM 93.2. Bristol is our community.
Big Snoop Dogg.
Hello, Bristol, and welcome to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling, and with us to review the news this week is Deputy Leader of the Conservative Group and Councillor of Enbury, Mark Weston. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, two buildings have stood empty for decades in Stokes Croft, the Carriage Works and Westmoreland House, so a local action group's being launched today to bring them back into use. So why do these owners choose to leave these enormous buildings derelict for such a long time? And what do the local people intend to use the buildings for? Simon Lewis is here to explain. And food mapping. How secure is our supermarket food supply? And where can we find locally grown food in Bristol? Linda Hull's here from Somerset Community Food. Plus, as our final piece around the 10th anniversary of 9/11, we point the spotlight at the top US politicians. Who was running things on the day of the attacks? Former arms manufacturer turned Vice President Dick Cheney or the President George W. Bush? And finally, the New World Order, a secret network of bankers, media barons, crooked politicians, arms producers lurking in the shadows, or the raving of crazed conspiracy theorists. Along with the Freemasons, it's one of the great taboos of the Western world. Who's used the term New World Order over the years? And what, if anything, does it mean today? That's in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 11 Celsius and some rain. This weekend, highs of 16 Celsius, fairly wet and windy. Next week, highs 16 Celsius, plenty of showers. And this week, but also few sunny spells. Next weekend, that's the 24th and 25th of September, highs of 11, down to 11, fairly wet with sunny spells. Well, it sounds like sort of April showers in September, doesn't it? That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Time to introduce this week's guests, and joining us is the Deputy Leader of the Conservative Group and Councillor for Henbury, Mark Weston. Hi, Mark, and welcome to Drive Time.
Good evening.
Now, first of all, do you have a day job as well as being a councillor?
Yes, actually. I'm afraid still in politics, though. I'm the agent for Ashley Fox, member of the European Parliament for Bristol.
Okay, and what brought you to the Conservative Party rather than one of the other parties?
I think what brought me to the Conservatives initially was the emphasis on the individual. I always want, because you go through it and you study politics and things like that, As I was looking around, I believe in individual responsibility for the actions, and I thought that was best reflected in the Conservative Party. So here I am.
What about the perception, anyway, that the Conservatives is just for the rich and for the wealthy in society and not really for everybody else? And it's a kind of elitist side to that.
I think the reputation is there, the stereotype is there, and there are other stereotypes that go with all the other political parties as well. It actually isn't true, though. I really wish I were wealthy. I wouldn't need the day job, but I most assuredly am not.
And what is your role as deputy leader of the Conservative group on City Council? What does that entail?
Well, I suppose you put yourself in the party hierarchy, isn't it? Do you have the leader? You're one of the officers. The leader is normally the public face. The deputy leader is there to take over when the leader is away. So, for example, the June council meeting when we talked about education and the primary school place problems there, then I would lead on that. It's really straightforward. It's a standard hierarchy.
Okay, and what about committees? Which committees are you on?
Resources and audit are my primary committees, but I also sit, for example, on the Bristol Development Framework, Housing Management Board, the working group set to look at the Parks and Green Spaces strategy. I'm on that, and there's a whole host of other committees as well.
Now, the parks thing has been burbling on really since the last election, hasn't it, in May? Can you tell us how that's been going? Because kicked into touch or what?
No. The group set up to look at the strategy, but the agreement of the group was that we wouldn't be making any public announcements prior to the final recommendations. So as much as I would love to talk about it, I'm afraid I'm not going to tonight.
And also auditing, because that's quite an important job, isn't it? You know, all of the public money that's spent by the City Council, the countless millions, you're in charge of making sure it's all been spent correctly.
Well, resources is in charge of the actual finance as well. Audit does overlap that, but also audit looks at the processes by which we do things. So it isn't necessarily just financial. Audit is a little bit more than that. But no, the resources is looking at the millions that we spent. For example, the resources committee there early today, we were looking at the proposals for things like solar cells on council roofs and what's the cost on that, what's going to be the benefit to it, things like that, which I think that's quite an exciting idea.
And to what extent are these council meetings open to the public? I wouldn't necessarily say they're the most exciting meetings to go along to, but if there's something...
Oh, they're thrilling, I assure you.
if there's something that concerns you, you know, you may wish to go along. Are they completely open to the public?
Completely open to the public.
And they all take place at the council house?
They all take place at the council house, and in fact, earlier today in resources, and it is rare we get a representation from the public outside of budget time, but no, we had public statement today and people in the audience.
And if there's someone just there to watch, are they able to actually contribute if they want to?
Well, you can submit a statement in advance and submit questions and petitions, things like that, but no, it's the public are able to watch the committee deliberate how we reach the decisions, but no, there is no formal input outside of the public forum at the beginning of the meeting.
Now, what's your thoughts about the general state of the Conservatives in Bristol? Because, you know, you're kind of on the fringes, and you have been for many years. Are we going to see, as has happened in Westminster, the Conservatives storming ahead of the Liberals here?
Well, you've got to hope so, but that'll be up to the electorate to decide. And they won't be going to the ballot box here for another year and a half.
Because in a way, you're kind of holding the balance of power in a certain way, because the Labour Party and the Liberal Party are traditionally the biggest two parties in the city. We've got the Greens coming along fast. But, yeah. Are you able to do sort of deals between one and the other, saying, well,
make
look,
it sound
you know,
like the New World Order here now.
So, how does that actually work?
I mean,
because you're the third biggest party, but you're... So, as such, you should be able to sort of cut deals between Labour and the Liberals and actually have quite a lot of influence.
Well, the thing is, you can actually influence with everything. I mean, the council tends to get the headlines for being all party political and about what we disagree on. But actually, a lot of the things can be reached out at consensus, and there are things that we do agree on. So I don't want to put that there. I would hope that we'll have a good showing at the next elections. If you look at the South Mead by-election, actually, I think we did fantastically well. I think Rhonda was a great candidate, and we'll see what happens in 18 months' time.
Well, we're also joined by old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. But before we hear from you, Martin, we're going to hear from Nick Clegg, who was speaking this week at one of the most august economics institutions in the country, the London School of Economics.
Good morning to all of you. Today, I'm going to talk about the economy. And I'm certainly, of course, in the right place. For more than a century now, LSE scholars have been at the forefront of every single major economic debate, asking and answering the most pressing questions of the day. Today, the big question facing governments is this. Given the unprecedented pressures in the global economy, what can we do to restore stability and encourage growth? The Coalition will be saying more about that between now and our autumn statement in November. But I wanted to make this speech today because the international situation has changed dramatically. It is worse even to just 6 months ago. To quote Christine Lagarde, the new head of the IMF, we are in a dangerous new phase. A huge rise in oil and food prices, a slowdown in overseas markets, continued turmoil in the Eurozone, ongoing uncertainty in the United States. Far from a one-off shock, the 2008 banking crisis has set off a chain reaction that continues to reverberate around the globe. And here in the United Kingdom, we're still feeling the pressure. This week we've heard that inflation is still high at 4.5%. And in the last hour, we've been told that unemployment has risen. So the reality we face is stark. There is now little margin for error. But that does not mean we are helpless. It does not mean we intend just to sit on our hands while the global economy falters.
That was Nick Clegg speaking on Wednesday this week at the London School of Economics. Martin, this London School of Economics, surely they've got the answers, haven't they?
Well, I mean, as Nick pointed out, they've been at the forefront of economic debate. So you've had people of various persuasions going through their doors over the years. It used to be known as a kind of Fabian socialist institution, and then it became known as a sort of Hayekian free market institution. So it's just had lots of economists through it who don't necessarily agree.
So are the debates happening at the LSE? Do you think they are actually going along to the politicians and telling them what to do now?
No, politicians choose their advisers from those who tell them what they want to hear, and so there's always, you know, the debate continues even in private.
But some of the things you're saying there are pretty worrying. Dangerous new phase, Christine Lagarde's saying, and also talking about a chain reaction. Well, a chain reaction is something that's almost unstoppable, isn't it?
That's the danger. I mean, basically, I think most of the political class, and I include in this the new Labour leadership, have been incredibly complacent about the dangers we face. There is a real danger of a banking collapse of a kind we haven't seen since the 1930s, and possibly worse than the 1930s, because in the 1930s, banks were basically illiquid rather than insolvent.
What's the difference?
Well, the difference is illiquid means that they just haven't got enough money to cover their immediate costs, as it were, and the calls that are being made on them. Insolvent means that they're bankrupt, and I'm afraid the banks are frankly bankrupt. The Japanese banks have been bankrupt for 20 years, for example. Our banks are now in the same place. They're zombie banks. I think they've got to be wound up and a whole new system put in place. But that's, people aren't willing to contemplate that until they actually implode, which is, I'm afraid, what could well happen.
Well, there was none of that in Nick Clegg's speech at the London School of Economics, but one of the things he did say was transport infrastructure. Is he going to be able to actually build this transport?
What I thought was interesting about what he was saying about infrastructure spending is, in Scotland, where you've still got Keynesian ministers like Alex Salmond in charge, they've brought forward infrastructure spending in order to try and, you know, basically get the government spends more money than it otherwise would on things like railways and trams and what have you, in order to try and boost the economy.
But of course, that's just going to make the deficit worse, isn't it?
Yeah, but if the economy goes down, the deficit's getting worse as we speak. I mean, basically, the problem is that there's been a whole generation of neoliberal thinking at the top, where the idea is that if you're running out of money, you've just got to cut back. Now, the danger with that, as Keynes pointed out in the 30s, is that the economy falters, it's now faltering, and then the deficit gets bigger because your tax receipts go down and your expenditure on things like unemployment benefit go up. Now, this has always been the problem. New Labour didn't grasp the net, and I don't see the Coalition doing it either.
Well, Mark Weston, Deputy Leader of the Conservatives on Bristol City Council, it's like a custard pie in the face for George Osborne. I mean, what Nick Clegg is actually saying there is we've got inflation going up now, we've got also unemployment going up, and it, as Martin was just saying there, the deficit is increasing, not decreasing.
Yeah. I think if you actually look at what Martin was saying there, he was saying that you should spend more money now. Now, that money has to come somewhere. And I would say when you talk about Keynes and you talk about the 30s, if you look at America and the New Deal, they put a massive amount of money into the American economy and didn't get out of recession till the Second World War. So this idea that you can spend your way to recovery, I'm sorry, I don't think it adds up. But if you actually look at what we're trying to do. We have to get the deficit under control. We have to get our debt under control because the money markets in the world are punishing countries that don't. You only have to look at what's happening in Greece, Ireland. They're now looking at France, Italy, Spain. All of those are facing increasingly high percentages on their debts that they're having to repay. And I think we do need to consider that a year ago, you know, when Labour left power, we were spending £120 million a day just servicing our debt. And you are right, that hasn't really gone down. That's £120 million just servicing it. That's more than we spend on care for the elderly, it's more than we spend on education, and it's untenable in the long term. You simply cannot keep spending money you don't have, particularly not when you're taking that money from private investors or even foreign governments that are going to want to be sure that you can repay it. And what we're seeing in Europe is they're not sure that these countries can repay it. At the moment, they're still willing to lend to us because they think we have the political will to make the necessary, and albeit rather nasty, if you will, cuts, because they are going to have an impact. There are going to be people lose their jobs, and I have the deepest sympathy for that. I genuinely do. But where's the money? And that's what I think is lacking.
Well, I used to teach A-level economics, and what I would be saying to my students now is those who can explain to me why the deficit will increase as a result of cuts will get their A stars. Those who say you can't spend money you haven't got haven't understood macroeconomics. My tutors at Oxford many years ago basically used to poo-poo this kind of theory. Don't forget that the money markets, who we've got to kowtow to, have just been bailed out by the state. And if they hadn't been bailed out by the state, they would be in no position to demand anything. And of course, if you had the political will, as Roosevelt did, to break the back of the money markets, and of course he sent a lot of bankers to prison, lots of bankers were sent to prison in the 1980s by a Republican administration. We've not had anybody sent to prison yet in this country.
Well, it looks like we may have this
and
week.
If you're serious about breaking the financial markets, we've got to move beyond private capital markets. The private capitalist market has failed. The financial markets have failed. We need to wind up the private financial system and put in place a publicly owned system. Now, nobody's talking about that yet. They will be.
You still can't answer the question, though, of the issue here, that FDR put a massive amount of money. He spent exorbitantly in America, and they didn't get out of recession.
They did. They did get out of recession in the mid-30s, long before anybody else. I mean, Britain carried on in recession right up to 1939 because we didn't do the things that Germany and America were doing. And, of course, once the war started, money was no object. Suddenly you can put the top rate of tax to 96% because it's national survival at stake. And if we are in a national emergency, I think the wealthy classes that have done very well out of the neoliberal bubble in the last 30 years, many of them started off as millionaires and now billionaires, it's time to pay for the breakages. Somebody has to pay for the crisis. We can't just spend our way out. You're quite right. The people who must pay for it are the top 5% in this country who control something like 60% of the national wealth. They have got a one-off wealth tax, has been suggested by Greg Filer of Glasgow University. We could wipe the deficit out in one go with a one-off wealth tax on the wealthy classes who've done so well.
So your entire strategy of getting out of this debt is to requisition wealth from any of those that have actually worked hard,
strived hard. They haven't worked hard, they've ripped us off.
Oh, come on. That's a broad generalisation.
It's not a broad generalisation.
You know
the banks basically have been having a free ride on the rest of the society. They were bailed out 4 years ago. They've gone straight back to the casino.
Mark's talking about the banks. He's talking about wealthy individuals.
Martin, only two banks were bailed out. But the rest of the banks weren't. You're making a broad generality.
Yeah, but the banking system is a system. And if those two banks hadn't been bailed out, you'd have had a knock-on effect. And that's what's going to happen now. If the Greeks default, there will be a knock-on effect on other countries and on the banks. Basically, the British banks are staring, as we speak, down the barrel of a gun. If Greece defaults, the euro implodes, the British banks in the City of London will really go bust. They're all bust already. So, they're only staying in business on the basis of Enron-style accounting. They're zombie banks.
Mark, can I just ask you one thing about this? Is this whole business of the banks themselves, do you think that they are actually culpable in all this? Because if you're looking at what Martin was saying just then about the Enron-style accounting, there are question marks over whether they've actually been honest in their assets. And this is one of the reasons that they're saying now
Mark's a magic.
That they're now trying to separate high street banks. That's our personal savings from these kind of casino banking. What do you think about that concept?
I mean, I do have an issue with that concept. It's more of a concern, I suppose. That what they're trying to do is they're trying to separate the money that's given to you and I for things like mortgages and loans from their investment banking. But when the crisis actually hit, it started in the American mortgage market. Now, that's the bit that they're saying is secure. But what they did there was they took $100,000 mortgage in America, and they kept pricing it up, expecting house prices to continue to go up. So it changed hands a few times, and it's suddenly 300,000. The mistakes actually were in the mortgage market. That's
in,
from, and
in
I
the derivatives market.
Derivative market.
The derivatives market, basically, they took these basic mortgages, they changed them into complicated derivatives and then sold them on. So if you, it's not like an old building society lending somebody money to buy a house. They basically, as soon as they've lent the money, they then sell the debt on to somebody else. So they're not really interested in whether it's a good debt or not. And that shouldn't have been allowed at all. But it was, and that's why we're in a mess.
Now, one of the places around the world that all this is being discussed is down in Marseille, as the G8 finance leaders get together, and the US Secretary of Finance has flown over as well. Martin, I don't know how much you've been following this, but do you think they're going to come out with a solution? I'm looking at the New York Times headlines now, and we've got the IMF chief, Christine Lagarde, basically telling them, we must have bold action, but there doesn't. Everyone else in the picture, as I'm looking at here, seems to be sort of scratching their heads and looking glum.
Don't you get a bit fed up with politicians talking about the need for bold action?
Well, I mean, they do need bold action, but the kind of thing they're talking about is basically having a European super state which will issue euro bonds, which will then stabilise the market. But don't forget, the fundamental problem we face is that the banks, even those that weren't bailed out, are in fact bust. A lot of the derivatives they're carrying on their books are not worth what the face value says they're worth. And if they were made to mark to market, they are all bust, including Barclays. Now, what should you do with bankrupt businesses? You're a conservative. I know what you should do. You know what you should do. You should wind them up. We're not winding them up. We're bailing them out and hoping that they will somehow come right. They won't.
Mark, we are in this situation of what you might call a debt spiral, where it looks like the debt is so great that the governments have, including, of course, this bailout money, that however much they tax people over the future, that's going to have a detrimental effect in the future. They're going to be getting less and less and less tax, and the debt is growing all the time. It's a kind of death spiral of debt. How are we going to get out of that?
Are you talking in the British sense or the European sense?
I'm talking both senses.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, if we look at the European and we'll come on to the UK, I think the problem, the only thing worse than Greece defaulting, because Greece will default, I'm sorry, defaulting in 2 years' time,
of course
is... Yeah, is the fact, is them, the only thing worse rather than them defaulting tomorrow is them defaulting in 2 years' time after we give them another 110 billion euros. And those that say Britain isn't contributing, well, we are, it's via our IMF contributions, which were 6 billion, they're going to be 14 billion. We are going to be bailing out people in Greece, and I think that is unfair.
And ultimately, we're not going to get that money back, are we?
No,
it's we're throwing good money after bad.
Let's just clarify, what we're doing, the Greeks won't see any of that money, we're bailing out our own banks. The German taxpayers are bailing out their own banks. We don't have to bail out Greece, but if we don't, our banks will take the hit, and then they will go down.
Okay. Let Mark finish.
The thing with that is, actually, I mean, our banking exposure to Greece is about 14 billion. Now, we're paying an increasing amount to the IMF of 14 billion to help bail out Greece. I don't think it's going to do any good in Greece. You could make an argument, is it not better just to give that to try and cushion the blow to our banks? Because Greece are going to default.
One of the other major questions that we've been really coming up against again and again on this show is the lack of George Osborne actually using, and the government generally in the Treasury, using the government shareholding in companies like RBS and Lloyds to actually force them to lend to small businesses, and actually to start using that shareholding to actually direct the way the banks are going. And it seems that there's a real timidity with the previous Labour government and this present Conservative government. I think a lot of people were hoping the Conservatives were going to bite the bullet here, to actually engage and to say, right, we are going to tell these banks to behave, because there's a power struggle going on between the banks and the politicians. And I think the public really want to know that the politicians are in charge in that struggle, and the banks aren't.
I can kind of see your point there, and I would probably agree with it. I think the problem for some of the banks, and particularly the ones like RBS and things like that we own, is that we're asking the banks to do two things. We're asking them to increase their liquidity so they have more in reserve, and at the same time asking them to lend more. And that's kind of a bit of a problem for the banks, because they can really only do one at any one time, and we're trying to get them to do both at once, which means they're doing both averagely. Really, what they should be doing is concentrating on increasing liquidity, and then, because we don't want them to go bust, as has been said, but then they have to really get the loans going.
So what are the problems? Why is it, Martin, that George Osborne is not simply telling the banks what to do?
Mark's put his finger right on it. I mean, it's contradictory to ask the banks to lend more to small businesses, and that's presumably the retail arm of the banks that we were asking them to do that, at the same time as we're asking them to build up their capital base so that they are actually solvent. I don't think by any attempt to build up their capital bases is going to make them solvent. They are bust. they will remain bust.
So
but I mean, the retail banking people are quite logical and saying, look, the economy's just about to go into a double dip recession. There's little point lending to small businesses because those small businesses will go bust. Just reasonable prudential lending means that we're not going to lend to those people. Ultimately, the macroeconomic policy falls back on the government. We're talking now about having quantitative easing because of the slowdown in the economy. You could just stop the cuts and not switch on the money machine. That would be one of the things. It wouldn't solve the problem. That just keeps your head above the water. But if you drown yourself, you drown.
As the fudge goes on in Marseille today and this weekend, we've had your answer what you would do, Martin, which is pretty much to wind up these banks and basically take them over, take over the cash points. What would you do, Mark? What would you think we should be doing?
Well, the thing is, I actually don't believe that we should stop the process of the cuts. We do need to get our debt and our deficit under control. It is far too high. We can't have the money market start to punish us. The answer to the Eurozone problem for me, and I don't think it'll ever happen, is Germany leaves the Euro. I think that would let the Euro
devalue. It may well happen.
Well, I mean,
this is a crisis.
Yeah, I mean, Merkel, for the first time ever in Germany, 35% of Germans describe themselves now as Eurosceptic. There is no Eurosceptic party in Germany, and for the first time, she's going to be going into elections, I think, next year, with this as a real problem. And we've seen in Finland, which has come from the same way, that the true Finns went from a couple of percentage to 21% in the general election. Now, Merkel's going to have a serious problem. And the same is happening in France. If you look at Le Pen, you know, the French nationalists, they're having a similar thing. The backlash on this, it politically, could be
so as just as certain political leaders are talking about a kind of political union in Europe, we've got parties growing up around in a very, very quick rate of knots, saying completely the opposite. So it's a kind of political crisis brewing there as well.
Well, I mean, the euro itself, I mean, a single currency can work in certain situations, but it can only work if the economies of the countries that are actually together are in sync, if they're converged. And what we have in the Eurozone is that they're not. Yes, you know, France and Germany and probably Holland, Austria, and I suppose maybe Belgium as well, they are fairly in sync. They could probably carry on as a Eurozone, but they should never have bolted on a lot of these Mediterranean countries that simply aren't able to support and work in that market, and
so
that's what they've done.
Finally, with you, Martin, what's your guess? Is it the Eurozone going to fracture?
Absolutely. The problem is how to get through this crisis and wind up the banks, wind up the euro, change what we're doing in an orderly fashion. We can't. It'll happen in a disorderly fashion if it's not done in an orderly fashion. And we saw that in the 30s, because you then end up with everybody playing beggar my neighbour with all of the consequences. And that's what I mean. It's a serious crisis. Christine Lagarde is not joking when she says this is, you know, we're staring down the barrel of a gun here.
Okay. Well, on to our next story. Prime Minister's question. Prime Minister's questions this week. We had the Conservative MP Sir Peter Tapsell talking about overmighty subjects. And also mentioning the famous 18th century Bristol MP, Edmund Burke.
Sir Peter Tapsell.
Was my right honourable friend taught at whatever school he happened to attend that one of the key functions of Parliament over the centuries has been to diminish what the historians have called the overmighty subject. In the 18th century, it was the Indian nabobs denounced by Edmund Burke. In the 19th century, it was the ruthless industrialists humanized by Shaftesbury. In the 20th century, it was the trade union leaders tamed by Lady Thatcher. Yeah. Today, the almighty subject is the bankers.
Yeah.
In the United States, the federal authorities are prosecuting a wide swathe of the top banks. When is that going to happen here?
Yeah. Well, first of all, the right honourable gentleman obviously had a much better education than I did. That is apparent. Also, it was very good to hear him say something very positive about Margaret Thatcher. That is also a... I think that the serious point the right honourable gentleman is making is right, that we do need to see responsibility from our bankers. I support what Vickers has said in terms of the reforms that we need. And to answer his question directly, if people break the law, no matter where they come from or who they are, they should face the consequences and be punished.
That was Prime Minister's questions on Wednesday, and of course they are facing the consequences, Martin, aren't they? Looks like somebody here, banks are under new pressure as a rogue trader loses £2 billion. He's just been arrested. As if by magic, we are arresting bankers.
Yes, but I mean, he's a very low-level trader. I mean, what Peter Tapson's talking about there is senior managers. And James Galbraith, who is the son of John Kenneth Galbraith, the famous US Keynesian economist, has been banging on about this for the last 2 years, saying if you want to restore faith in the financial markets, you've got to send some of these top guys to proper prisons with looters and rioters.
Well,
and
have they actually done anything wrong? And if
no, they
have.
Goldman Sachs at one stage,
have they broken the law?
Well, yes, they have. They've broken existing law. But the problem is what the Latin Americans call impunidad. Wealthy, powerful people can break the law and get away
impunity.
With it. Impunity, yeah. I mean, basically, Goldman Sachs at one stage was selling derivatives out of the front of the shop, which had been designed to fail, and the traders who were selling those derivatives did not know that the senior managers had taken loads of short positions on those derivatives. That is fraud under existing law. But of course, they're so powerful, Goldman Sachs are the biggest contributors to American political parties of all kinds, and it's very difficult to get these people. Look at Mr. Berlusconi, richest man in Italy. Police have been chasing him for years, but he's still there. This is the issue. And as ultimately, that when I said earlier, where's the money going to come from to reboot the economy? Some of it's going to come through raising taxes on the wealthy. Others is going to come from confiscating their assets and sending them to prison.
Now, Mark Weston, Deputy Leader of the Conservatives on Bristol City Council. We've had the Vickers report out this week, the long-awaited independent, so-called, in inverted commas, Commission on Banking, with lots of bankers on it. And it seems that is going to be implemented. But no splitting of the casino banking and high street banking until 2019. Do you think that's quick enough?
Well, I think things do actually need to change, but the only problem is if they change too quickly, as you were saying earlier on, if things happen too fast in a disorderly manner, you'll actually cause an awful lot of damage. I think things do need to go carefully, and this is going to be a fundamental change, the biggest change to our banking sector, probably since free market economics even came in. So it does need to take its time. It does need to be very careful. I would agree with Dave Cameron and my colleague here that if the bankers have broken the law, then they go to prison. It is straightforward as that.
But that's his job, surely, to actually call for that, but he's not really doing it, is he?
Well, I mean,
he's saying, yes, it should happen, but Cameron himself isn't calling for it. Is he scared of the bankers?
I would hope not. That's as much as I can say on that one. I mean, If the bankers broke the law, then they should be investigated by the police, the Crown Prosecution Service, and they should go to jail.
And so are you glad to see this chap arrested yesterday?
This guy yesterday, I mean, he definitely broke the law, and, well, allegedly broke the law, but careful on the words on it. But this is a different situation to what we're actually having the banking crisis that kicked all this off.
And the Financial Times as well is saying that a rogue trader at UBS, this is the bank where this guy was working at, or is it a rogue bank? It's nice to see the Financial Times actually raising that question. Is it that they're just sort of picking on a low-level guy, whereas actually there's systemic problems at some of these big banks?
Well, I mean, the problem for this seems to be it's the supervision given to the traders. I mean, this guy is fairly low-level in the situation, yet he still managed to run up $1.2 billion in debt. And he did it by making a mistake, thinking that he could cover it again by making a bigger profit and no one would ever know. And he gradually got on this spiral and down he sunk. But who was watching him? That's the problem. His manager should have known what he was doing and didn't. And it's the same as we saw happen with Nick Leeson. This is the same kind of thing. But it's not any of the top people. These are just brokers on the shop floor, if you will.
So it's not just the Financial Services Authority that's not doing the regulation properly. It's also it's a lack of supervision within the banks themselves too. Because I think, you know, to a certain extent, a lot of these traders are encouraged to speculate, encouraged to take risks, because by taking those risks, they can make massive profits.
You look at Hollywood. Everyone likes the big chancer that makes good. Each one of these kind of people is looking to make that big hit that gets them in the history books for that fantastic sale, the one that gives them the massive bonus and everything else. You know, these people are only really in their jobs for a few years, and then they move on, and they move on wealthy. So that's one of the problems, and this is one of the issues we had with bankers' bonuses and things like that coming, is if you make a quick hit, you get your bonus and you're on for a couple of years. There's no investment. I mean, I did like the idea that came out at the time that bankers' bonus should actually be paid in 5 years if the bank made profit. So actually there's some long-term accountability to
it
that bonus.
It seems a bit strange that banks are making losses, but the bankers themselves are actually still taking bonuses. Martin, well, can you just sum up here? Finally,
the fundamental problem is that the banks are claiming to make profits, which are basically fraudulent because they're using Enron-style accounting. They've been allowed, in order to keep them in business, the authorities have basically said to them, right, we will go along with your fantasy that all of these derivatives on your books are worth what you claim they are. But if they try to sell those derivatives into the market, they'll be worth about a maximum 30% of their face value. Now, if you actually went through the banks properly, audited them properly, you would find that they are all bankrupt, and they have been for a considerable time. Now, it's actually dysfunctional under any kind of system for bankrupt entities to continue trading, especially when you're paying out bonuses, you're paying off shareholders. That money is based on no profits at all. This is malinvestment, using the Austrian free market school terminology. It's malinvestment. There are no profits, and we are allowing these people, by support from the state, to carry on as if nothing had happened. As soon as the banks were in the wards of the state should have asserted its authority over them. But in fact, what's happened is, instead of the banks being nationalised, the state is being privatised. And this, of course, will not be acceptable, and it won't work. The deficit will go up, and by Christmas it will be clear all over the world that that's what's happening.
OK, well, thanks for summing that up, Martin. Now, we're on to our next story, and David Cameron was over in Libya, triumphant, and really sort of announcing the takeover of Libya. So let's have a listen to that. That was yesterday.
Can I say what an honour it is to be here in Tripoli with you to see how the Libyan people are taking their country back and taking it forward to a new era. A few weeks ago, Gaddafi was still in control here in Tripoli, and I think what the world has seen is, frankly, an impressive transformation. Your roads are full again of traffic, your water is flowing, your hospitals are working. This is impressive. And I'm proud of the role that Britain played in helping you to do this, and I'm even more proud, having seen what I've seen today, of the impressive changes you are making. But this was your revolution, not our revolution. It was those brave people in Misrata, in Benghazi, in Brega, in Zlitan, in Tripoli, in the Nafusa Mountains, who were incredibly brave in removing the dreadful dictatorship of Gaddafi. And I pay tribute to those people throughout Libya today. It is your revolution, it is their bravery that has enabled this to happen. As Nicola has said, we want to help you diplomatically, militarily, economically, and with your development. We are your friends, but this is your country, your leadership, your plan. We stand ready to help, but we want to know what it is you most want us to do. This does go beyond Libya. This is a moment when the Arab Spring could become an Arab summer, and we see democracy advance in other countries too. And I believe you have the opportunity to give an example to others about what taking back your country can mean.
That was David Cameron speaking yesterday over in Tripoli. Now, Mark Weston, are you happy to see what's happened over there? Do you think that this is a successful intervention? Because you really have to be quite plucky, don't you, to go halfway across the world, intervene in a country and try and sort it out. Do you think this has all worked out nicely?
Well, compared to previous military adventures in recent decades, then yes, I absolutely do agree. I actually applaud it. I mean, you look at what was going to happen. Benghazi was going to be stormed by Gaddafi loyalists, and that would have been a bloodbath. We stopped that. We haven't put feet on the ground. A few spotters and special forces going in now just to try and find Gaddafi. But I think it was the right approach. The heavy lifting was done by the Libyan people. And the rebels, although I suppose at some point we have to stop calling them rebels. If you flip that on its head to look at what happened in Iraq, where we went in and thought we could fix it all ourselves, there was no real uprising that we supported, not this time anyway. I think Libya, we got it right.
Martin?
Yeah, there's been obviously a lot of debate in the anti-war movement in the country about Libya, and it caused a lot of heart-searching, and different positions were taken. My view at the early stages was that I'm not necessarily opposed to a no-fly zone. I was an aid worker in Bosnia, there was a no-fly zone there. I think we should be cautious about the situation. Don't forget that the rebels or whoever we want to call them, the insurgents or whatever,
transitional government.
There's a number of factions in there. One of which is the Islamic Fighting Group, for example, which is Al Qaeda Libya, who have been working with MI6 for many, many years. That shouldn't surprise anybody that that's what is going on. And maybe an Al Qaeda led Libya won't be a disaster because in actual fact there's possibly people involved in Al Qaeda are perfectly reasonable people. But at the same time, The National Transitional Council's statement says that they do intend to enforce Sharia law in Libya. That's clear. But that's a common aspiration for Islamist political forces everywhere. Now, this could turn out right in terms of being a democratic country that we can all be proud of, or it could turn into a civil war yet. And also there's then going to be questions about women's rights and so on. And also there's going to be questions about who's going to get the oil contracts. Now, the Chinese are sitting there saying, well, we had all the oil contracts with Gaddafi. Are we going to get a look in now? And the answer is probably no. And that, of course, will make them annoyed and fed up and feel that they've been badly treated.
One of the things that strikes me as a bit rather distasteful is that the new Prime Minister in Libya has spent most of his life living in the US and Britain. And I imagine most Libyans would rather have someone who's a bit more inculcated with Libyan culture.
I think the thing is that we don't as yet know the shape of the democracy that Libya is going to take. We don't know. I think the Libyan people have a chance. Under Gaddafi, it was ruthless, it was autocratic, and, you know, it wasn't a pleasant place to be. There are genuine signs of jubilation,
but he's
not there.
It was actually a very, very good... they had very, very good health care, for example. They had one of the lowest child mortality rates in the whole of Africa in Libya.
I don't hold with the argument that you should sacrifice your freedom for better health care. I'm sorry, that doesn't stack up to me. We don't know what's going to happen now in the Libyan government. There is a chance that it will all end well. It is a better chance than it would have done if we hadn't gone in to stop him storming into Benghazi. Remember, we didn't start this rebellion. They started this rebellion. We went in to try and stop a bloodbath. And I think we're right to do that.
There is a question about how this started. If you look on the French Air Force website, you will see Operation Southern Mistral 2011 was mentioned on the Air Force websites on the 1st of November last year. And that was a war game, a joint war game between the French and British Air Forces of exactly what happened.
But a war game isn't a war, Martin.
No, but don't forget the Islamic Fighting Group, who are playing a prominent role in the new transitional government, they have been working with Western intelligence services for many years. So there is a considerable suspicion that this is not an entirely spontaneous uprising. It doesn't mean that it's not successful or that people don't want it to happen. I'm just saying that there is a serious question mark about how spontaneous all this has actually really been.
I would agree with that. A war game isn't a war game. You run war games on any possibility or eventuality that can happen. If you look in Israel, they regularly do war games on what's going to happen if they're attacked from numerous axes. We ran war games during the Cold War about what happens if the Russians push over the border, etc.
There was an Arab Spring at the beginning of the war game, which had not started in November last year, so the war game predicted an Arab Spring, which all of the Middle East experts and so on didn't realise was going to happen.
But you have to prepare for every eventuality.
Okay. Well, indeed, but it still opens questions about how spontaneous the whole thing is.
We'd ask more questions if we didn't prepare.
I'd like to move on to the next story, and that's a shake-up of the political map for the Bristol area. And we've seen some quite serious changes to the existing constituency boundaries. Boundary Commission for England has announced proposals to redraw constituencies as part of a plan to reduce the number of MPs nationwide from 650 to 600. Filton and Bradley Stoke seat, for example, could be broken up after only 5 years of existence, whilst neighbouring Thornbury and Yate would be divided in two, with parts of the Filton seat added to each new constituency. Lib Dem Pensions Minister's constituency was seen as being the worst affected in the Bristol region, and that's Steve Webbs. He must now choose whether to stand in the new Thornbury and Filton seat, likely to be also contested by Filton and Bradley Stoke MP Jack Lopresti at the next general election, or running Yate, which includes a number of Conservative strongholds from south of the M4. Mark Weston, I imagine that you've at least got your head around some of these changes. What about the principle that's at stake here, ultimately, which is actually reducing the numbers of members of Parliament? Do you think that's actually a good thing to do, a positive thing?
Yes, I do. I mean, it's ultimately, I know we're talking small money, but comparatively, it's going to save £12 million. No, I do agree with that. I definitely agree with the proposals that they're going to equalise the size of the constituencies as much as possible. I mean, you have some constituencies with a population of 40,000, you have others with 90,000. Now, I think it's unfair that if you vote in constituency A with 40,000, your vote counts almost twice as if it did if you're in constituency with 90,000. So the principle, I think, is sound. Some of the boundary changes, and not so much here, but some of them have been a little strange. I mean, we talked earlier, the Forest of Dean is taking a ward out of Gloucester called Westgate. I think Gloucester Cathedral is in Westgate, so I don't know quite why it's expanding there, but this is only the first stage. This is a consultation. I mean, there's some kinks that should be worked out. But yeah, no, it's going to be interesting.
Martin?
Well, I'm not really convinced that we need to have less MPs. What you need MPs for is to hold the executive.
But we're saving money, Martin, aren't we?
No, no, but ultimately...
Mark's just pointed out £12 million.
Listen, MPs already have far too much constituency work than they can handle. So you reduce the numbers, they're going to have more to handle. Now, ultimately, MPs, of course, some of them are not really worth voting for, but then we've all got our opinions on that. MPs and politicians are our only mechanism for holding the real government to account. The real government is the permanent government and the vested interest behind that.
What do you mean?
Including the big companies.
Can you just explain what you mean by the permanent government?
Well, the state is not parliament. Parliament is largely a talking shop. The state goes on doing what the state does, usually under the influence of big interest groups like banks and military and industrial complex and so on. So you need more. Equal boundaries, I totally agree with. That's certainly, you can't have a situation where one vote in one constituency means more than another. I think we need to completely change the electoral system to a multi-member STV constituencies like they have in Ireland. Yeah, but of course, this will carry on. In Scotland, Northern Ireland and Wales, they will continue making their own arrangements.
I dread to live in your version of democracy on that side of the Iron Curtain.
I'm just talking about equal votes, yeah, like you.
Yeah. I think the situation, you're saying they already have too much casework. This is actually going to equalise the size of the constituencies around about the 78,000 mark, which is the same electorate as you have in Bristol South. It's the same electorate numbers as you have in Bristol North West, in North Somerset, in Western Supermare. So, actually, all it's doing is going to equalise the constituency size, which means that you're not going to have... So you're not increasing the amount of casework. You're just spreading it out better. And we can do that with less MPs, claiming less expenses, and a less drain on the public purse.
But you've got a certain amount of caseworks generated, and if you've got a larger number of people in your constituency, which you're bound to have under the system, of course an MP's going to have to do more work.
But most MPs aren't, because if you look at what's happening, a lot of the constituencies in places like Wales and Scotland and up in the north are small constituencies. A lot of them in England, traditionally in the southeast, but there are also some in the southwest as well, are overly large. Actually, in some constituencies, they're going to have less casework. So I don't fully hold with that argument.
Well, I'm worried about this in a general way, because it could end up being a gerrymander. And what's really worrying to me is that we already know that the electoral register is corrupt. Just in Southmead the other day, for example, I knocked on the door where there'd be one person registered, and there was clearly a family living in the house. Now, this we know it's compulsory at the moment to register to vote, and in fact, lots of people don't register even under the current system, mostly poor people, mostly in the inner cities. Now, I understand that there is going to be a voluntary electoral register from 2011, so that those who don't want to register don't have to, and that the electoral registers will then be used as the basis for drawing up the boundaries of the constituencies. Now, this, in fact, leads to a situation like you've got in the United States of America, where maybe a quarter of the population, half the population, aren't registered to vote. Those who are registered are the wealthy householders in the more prosperous areas, and the system gradually gets skewed very much in favour of the comfortable classes. Now, that's okay. That's how Northern Ireland was run for many, many years, but it led to a war.
One of the other parts of this is that the House of Lords has accepted yesterday is to end, apparently, the deadlock over fixed-term parliaments. So that's now being passed, an agreement. Do you think that that's a good idea, to have a fixed-term parliament? Yeah. Because I can remember back in the 1970s, I think it was, that Harold Wilson actually used the threat of a general election to face down the City of London. And this surely is a tool that Prime Ministers should be able to use if they think, or governments should be able to use. If they think there's an issue which is really important for the future of the country, they should be able to call a snap general election and make a decision for the future based on that current time rather than 3 or 4 years previously.
No, I don't buy that one. I'm afraid I don't agree with it. I think too often, I mean, we had it when Brown became Prime Minister. He was looking for an opportune moment where he had the most advantage to call a snap election. I think it's a tool that Prime Ministers can use to wrest political advantage over their opponents. I do think that's unfair, and I think it's unaccountable, because it's not politicians. That was one case where they were facing down the city. But normally, it's just a tool for political advantage. This one makes it cleaner, more efficient. We know what's going to happen. I'm afraid, Martin, I'm delighted.
Fixed-term parliaments, good or bad?
Bad, because...
We're going to get them now.
But the point is that if there's a loss of confidence in the House of Commons and the Prime Minister loses a vote of confidence, say the Liberals walk out as the economy implodes towards Christmas, there will still have to be a general election under any system.
OK.
Well, only if there's no...
Well, if David Cameron hasn't got a majority in the House of Commons, then the potential that the Queen will call, you know, move towards a general election.
What happens in this system is the coalition could collapse, a hypothetical situation. It could collapse, but then can an alternative coalition be formed?
Oh, yes. But if it can't be formed, then it would
have a general election.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's got to be, even under a fixed term system, I'm not matching, but even under a fixed term system, if the Prime Minister of the day cannot find a majority in the House of Commons, ultimately there has to be an election, does there not?
And there would be an election under the system. But what this means is the Prime Minister cannot simply, at his own choice, call a snap election for political advantage.
Well, I mean, I might be in favour of that if we were reforming the whole system. But I mean, this kind of piecemeal reform which we go in for, I think is just going to lead to, until we actually get a written constitution with it all written down, I think we're going to carry on tinkering.
Okay, guys. Next story is a local one. Bristol taxpayers, and this is the headlines of the Evening Post yesterday, are funding a £20,000 legal fight against the Ashton Vale Stadium, famous Bristol City Football Club attempted move, and a supermarket being built, apparently, on the existing site. Mark, what's your feeling about this? Because it's basically a green fields they want to build this stadium in, isn't it?
Yeah, it most definitely is. I'm not happy with taxpayers' money going into this one. It just makes me nervous. It sets a precedent. I don't think it should happen.
Martin?
Well, I don't know enough about this case, and I only just saw this headline as we came on air, so I'm very loath to take a strong position either way.
The thing is that if, as the football club have done, they appeal, then surely the City Council, it's their job to pay solicitors to fight that appeal, and that's what this is all about.
I thought this was the one about there possibly being is it one of the parish councils are paying for it?
Oh, are they? Okay, parish councils can use this money for whatever they believe is in the interest of the area, which will benefit residents.
I thought this was the Long Ashton Parish Council, actually.
But is it Bristol City Council money that they're accessing? I mean, I don't understand.
Okay, let's just check this, because this is quite important,
isn't
it?
Fact check, quick.
The parish council has made a decision to give their financial backing just 11 days. Okay, you're right. Yes, absolutely right. Bristol City Council agreed in June to register only part of the 42-acre site as a town green. So it's not Bristol City Council money. It's a local parish council money from that area. Long Ashton Parish Councillors. So they're taking a pretty strong stand.
They are. I mean, ultimately, that's... I mean, that's their choice.
But it's their environment they're trying to protect,
yeah, I mean,
isn't it?
I mean, it is. I mean, it would make me uncomfortable to have Bristol doing it as a Bristol councillor. It's their council. They're responsible to their electorate. It's up to their electorate to decide whether they've overstepped the mark. I know the Bristol South MP, Dawn Primrola, I think she's reported it to Eric Pickles and asked for clarification on it. And I'll wait to see that one back, I'm afraid.
Now we've clarified all this, Martin, what are your thoughts about this stadium principle generally? Because we've also got the biggest eviction that's ever taken place in Britain, apparently, happening on Monday over in Essex, where £18 million is being spent evicting a bunch of travellers from a former scrapyard. And meanwhile, Bristol City Football Club is, it seems, quite possibly being allowed to build a massive stadium on green fields.
Well, this is the minefield of planning, isn't it? I mean, the coalition seems to me to be facing two ways on this. On the one hand, we're talking about localism and giving local communities more say over what goes on in their backyard. On the other hand, we're talking about making planning restrictions less onerous and reducing regulation on developers. Now, The coalition seems to be facing two ways on this, and there's always going to be a tension, is there not, between what local people want and what may be in the best interest of the wider society.
I think there is a difference, though, between the two cases, because the Bristol Stadium, whether
you
like it,
I'll tell you what the difference is. One was a scrapyard and one was beautiful green fields.
Well, no, I'll tell you what the difference is one of them got planning permission, the other one didn't. That's what's come down to it. The traveller site you're referring to did not have planning permission for that scale of development. The Bristol Stadium, whether you like it or not, was given planning permission. So what you have is the traveller site, and whatever your feelings on that are, they broke planning law. Bristol Stadium has not broken planning law, but this the money being spent now is the legal fight to carry it on. They're appealing that decision. One broke planning law, one didn't. They are different.
Martin, what
I think that's
about?
True, but then what some people would say is that the planning law is therefore an ass because it's biased in favour of corporate decisions.
Well, some people would say
than local decisions.
Well, some people would say that planning regulations really favour people who are going to build big developments because they bring in lots of council tax or business rate into the economy. So effectively, that means that the planning law is saying if we can tax it, you can do it.
I think it's not fair that people can't local councils or local communities which oppose a development cannot appeal, but developers can always appeal. And that's I used to have something to do vaguely with planning when I was working for the city council, and it was very clear that if the city council appealed, then it was going to cost a fortune. But the developers can always appeal. But if the local community doesn't get their decision they want, like Tesco's in Stokes Croft, they can't appeal.
I mean that is completely the case. Some of these developers are that, you know, the stadium is a massive development, but some of them are just two or three houses. So we don't put all developers in the same pot. But no, it's true. You can't appeal if you went there to fight the house being built next to you, whatever, and that your neighbour who's building it won, you can't appeal that. But if he lost, he could. And that is a thing.
Well, it's an anomaly, isn't it? What about this the business in Essex, though, Mark? Because it's a Conservative council that's doing that over in Essex. And the question, of course, is if these 200 families or so are evicted on Monday, as it looks like they will be, where are they supposed to live?
Well, the thing is, the Bristol, the Exeter, you would say, the Essex Council is in a bit of a quandary here, because
if they let
a breach of planning law go through,
well, they could grant planning permission, then it wouldn't be a breach of planning law.
But it hasn't met the requirements.
Actually, surely a caravan site is better than a scrapyard, isn't it?
It's got far too many caravans on it. It doesn't have the safety aspect to it. It has impact on roads. I mean, there are other situations in it. It would not be given planning permission if they applied now. It is too dense a development in too small a space.
The other problem, of course, is that Essex, as all councils, are supposed to provide enough traveller sites. They clearly haven't in that area. I mean, that's another aspect. So it seems that the council's over there is being a little bit naughty when it should be providing space. It's not provided space. These people have bought their own piece of land, found somewhere to live, and are being penalised because of it.
Yeah, but what they did was they bought a piece of land which had planning permission for half of the caravans that they've put on it. If they want to stay there, then they need another piece of land and they need additional planning permission. At the beginning of this process, they did do everything right. But what they've done... I mean, if your neighbour next to you built a house in his back garden without planning permission, there'd be a similar ruckus and you'd be tearing it down.
We've got something else which is quite close to home as well, and that is the big scandal, you could call it, this week about the asbestos being buried and dumped over at Chew Valley Lake. That's another one of these things which has got its planning permission, but it just seems completely counterintuitive. Why on earth are we burying poison next to the water supply for the city?
I'm afraid I don't know that case. So,
but they've got planning permission.
Anyway,
Martin, do you want to have a final word on this one?
I think that common sense should lead to compromise in most cases. I mean, clearly the letter of the law is with the council, but I think that common sense suggests that you can find some way to make everybody's interests.
But earlier on, you were saying follow the letter of the law in the case of the bankers.
Well,
is it the letter or the spirit?
Well, I think the planning law, in fact, it very much favours the big battalions as it stands.
It certainly doesn't favour the travellers. Anyway, thanks very much, folks. We're coming up to the Sky News at 6 o'clock. Thanks for this week's guest, Deputy Leader of the Conservative Group on Bristol City Council and Councillor for Henbury, Mark Weston. After the news, two buildings have stood empty for decades in Stokes Croft, the Carriage Works and Westmoreland House. So a local action group's been launched today to bring them back into use. Coming up after the news at 6. From the